Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome back, everybody. Hour number two is officially underway. It is at your service. I'm Mike Claiborne, and we've got some fun things to get into in this hour. But in the meantime, we'll talk a little bit about the last hour. And one of the things in talking with Robert Malik about Franklin Roosevelt, Robert Dalek, I'm sorry, I know it's Jim Malik, and I'm getting my names confused. But anyway, when you look at a Roosevelt, there's a couple of things that come into play. How many presidents since Roosevelt have taken a page or two to try and implement in their own administration and how they ran the government? That's one thing. The other thing would be this. Could Franklin Roosevelt govern today in this country the way things work, with the way the media works, with the way left versus right, conservatives versus liberals? You know, would he be able to be the unifier that obviously this country needs? I wonder if that would work today. Not to mention his own health issues. How would that be viewed today also? Probably the right guy for the right time. But certainly the things that he was able to implement, we still continue to see people try and get involved in. It's a very interesting time in our world. But certainly if you look back at what Franklin Roosevelt was able to do, I think he had a whole lot more on his plate now than a lot of presidents have had. So maybe it isn't a bad idea to go back to that playbook and look at some of the things. And interestingly enough, while you had Democrats and Republicans, I think that was a time when both sides figured out a way to work together, not just as president, but Congress and the Senate found ways to work together more times than not. Love to see that happen again. That's just one thing. All right. In this hour, I'll tell you about what we have going on. We got a few things going. One of which, we're going to get into a subject that, you know, honestly, when you look at how things work today and you think about what's going on, when it comes to finances, one of the things is, do you have enough? Do you have enough to take care of your family? Are you putting enough away? And there's a very good book. It's called The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope with the World of Uncertainty. And the world of uncertainty is that job that you once thought was like a civil service job where you had it for life. You'd be there 30, 35 years. Those jobs don't exist as much as they used to, especially when it comes to the manufacturing industry. So people have had to change careers, hence change salary structure. A lot of things go into play, but there are a lot of other things that you have to take into account when you're providing for a family and the planning that goes with it. So we invite you to stick around for that interview. Also, we're going to get into something that's kind of goofy here, but I'm a goofy guy from time to time. The book is called Quackery. Yeah, quackery. It's a brief history of the worst ways to cure things. I mean everything. And once you hear the author, and we're going to talk to Lydia King. She wrote the book and she's researched all the stuff that's in it. Once you hear about what some people think is a sure cure, you just scratch your head and just wonder, well, how's this person still alive? Some of these things work, some of them don't, but I'm not going to spoil it. We'll find out from Lydia King a little later about how these things work and how the impact they can have on a person's life. Also, we're going to talk with Eric Cole, Dr. Eric Cole. He's the author of an upcoming book. It's entitled Online Danger, How to Protect Yourself and Your Loved Ones from the Evil Ways of the Internet. And let's face it, we hear stories every day about this getting hacked, this being compromised, your accounts being jeopardized, your identity being stolen. All these things are constants, and they're not going to go away anytime soon. So what we thought we would do is talk to somebody who's got a vast experience in this field. He's worked for the government in a variety of capacities. He also holds a PhD in a number of different things. So we invite you to stick around and listen to Eric Cole. He's a very interesting guy that we think will certainly give you an idea, maybe develop your own template in your own family's security when it comes to the internet and just all the other things, including, oh yeah, that cell phone. So we'll have a chance to visit with him. So all those things are going to happen here in this hour. Also, with this being Sunday, I haven't had a chance to really ask this question. You know, I don't know what I've said it before. I walked away from the NFL this year. I don't watch it. I know it's on TV, and there are times where I will stick my head in the door just to see what a story might be. But there are so many reasons that I had to walk away from it, and now that I've learned I don't need it, I wonder how you feel. And I know a lot of people watch the NFL not for the games, because the games are terrible. The play is awful, but fantasy football has made a footprint in the NFL that they don't know what to do with, and I think it's probably saving the ratings in a lot of regard. So what do you do on Sundays? Do you shop? Do you read? Do you rake leaves? I mean, have you changed the way you do things because maybe the NFL is not part of what you do? Obviously, you're listening to me, so that's a good thing. I would suggest that anytime. But when you look at other things and other activities, I think once you realize you don't need something, life still goes on. Be interested to get your thoughts on that. Also, we're getting near that holiday season, and I want to know, how are you going to shop this year? You know me, I'm an online guy. I'm an internet guy now. Seldom will I walk through a store, and it's not that I don't like it. Well, no, I don't like it now that I think about it. It's just something I'm just not into. That convenience of pushing enter is just a lifesaver. I don't know how much of it you do. Some people just like to get out and inhale the environment, and that's okay. No problem with that at all. But some people have just said, I'm done with it. I don't want to park. I don't want to deal with the rudeness. I don't want to deal with this. And then all of a sudden, when you go look for something, all of it starts to look alike. And me, I don't have the patience. Going shopping with me is not a good thing. I don't care how much I care about her, whether it's a loved one or a girlfriend or whatever. I can only take so much of it. And I know there's a lot of guys listening, and you guys may be headed to the mall right now. So I'm going to give you guys some advice. Don't nod your head. Don't say, uh-huh. Don't do anything to acknowledge that I'm right. And she's not necessarily wrong, but she doesn't agree. You don't want to have a quiet car ride home because you agree with me. So I'm just suggesting now, just keep your eyes on the road. Don't say anything. Just have an internal grin, because you know what I'm telling you is right. All right, we're going to take our final break here. We're going to come back and get the second hour underway. We're glad you're with us today on a Sunday afternoon. It's At Your Service. It's KMOX, and I've got a frog in my throat. I'm Mike Claiborne, and we'll be back on Your Voice of St. Louis after this. It's At Your Service. I'm Mike Claiborne. Welcome back, everyone. We are here on a Sunday, and we're talking about a lot of different things, but this is one that I'm sure will hit everybody in some way, shape, or form. As you probably know, every family in this country is always trying to work to make everything better financially. And there was a time when everything would be in a pretty good situation. You could save money. You didn't have to worry about this or worry about that. That's all changed for a lot of different reasons. And we're going to talk to someone today who co-authored a book. It's called Financial Diaries: How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. And with us today is Rachel Snyder. Rachel, first of all, thank you very much for visiting with us, and welcome to KMOX.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Well, let's talk a little bit about it. You and I talked briefly about how things have changed in this country with regard to the finances of families and how they make it. Paycheck to paycheck is a little bit more common than most will admit. And, you know, we all think it's going to be better the next day. In a lot of cases, it isn't. So when you went through this and did the research and putting this together, what was the common item that you ran across with families as they try and maintain financial stability?
Well, the big story was really how volatile people's financial lives have become. So we have this sort of model that we use whenever we think about how to tell somebody to budget, right? Where you think, well, first you've got to figure out what your monthly income is, and then you figure out your monthly spending, and you subtract one from the other, and then you know what's left for you know, discretionary spending. But the reality is we saw such big swings, really big swings, in people's incomes from month to month that model just doesn't really work.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that stands out. And people don't have the recourse that maybe they think they have as far as making an adjustment, because let's face it, most people aren't financial planners. Most people don't have a finger on the pulse of how the industry works. Therefore, they're going by something that maybe they learned from their parents or their grandparents or what they've heard. And I'm not sure if that applies like it used to.
Yeah, it may not, right? I mean, just the example I just gave, like, I think doesn't really work for lots of people. And yet that's how you would traditionally be told to figure out how to budget. But a lot of Americans, you know, and not everyone, right? So the traditional models still work for plenty of people. But what we saw is that at the lower income levels, people who are working nonetheless still have big ups and downs from month to month and how much they earn. And that creates a whole different kind of challenge than what we've been advising people to worry about in the past.
We talk about savings all the time. Save, save, save. 65% of the households have a savings account, but only 8% of them have actually saved at least as much as they perceive they would. A lot of things happen. A lot of things slip through the cracks. And I think once families have to realize that they're not by themselves, do they find a way to come together? Do they try and improvise? What are you finding that most families are doing once they hit that wall?
Well, it is a lot about families helping each other. So we saw and heard so many stories among the families we worked with about saving and borrowing and lending to each other. As a matter of fact, in our sample, under 5%, like only under 5% of the people had no moment during the whole year that we tracked their financial lives in which they didn't borrow, save, share resources with somebody else. So for the most part, right, people are part of a community and they share resources within that community. You know, so if you think about it as, you know, everyone in a community might be experiencing lots of ups and downs in their income, and so they help each other balance that out.
That's if they have good family connections. For that person who is a first-time family member where they have their own family, maybe they live in a city where they don't have friends and family, it can be a little bit more of a challenge, I would assume.
Absolutely. And, of course, even if you're relying on friends and family, that means that, first of all, you're creating financial stress on that on your family, right? Because now they're not only taking care of themselves but also helping take care of you. And it means that any community can only help each other so much. It's bounded by the total resources in that community. And so you still have to figure out, I mean, I think we as a society still have to figure out how to get more resources into the communities that are struggling most.
We're visiting with Rachel Schneider. She, along with Jonathan Murdoch, have written a book. It's called The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. All right, Rachel, as I went through this book, there were a few chapters that kind of made your hair stand on end with regard to the potential disaster you see with families and the things that they eventually learn that they can't do and how things can spiral out of control. We recognize the problems. What are some of the solutions?
Well, you could think about it in a few different ways. One is you do have to take a look at how jobs function today. So the income volatility we saw was primarily the result of people who had steady work, right? They worked at the same job week after week, but they did not have steady paychecks because they had a different number of hours each week, or they relied on tips, or they relied on commissions, or their work was seasonal in some way. So we really do need to make a commitment to that if somebody works, they will be able to earn a living wage and have sufficient stability from that job. So some cities are starting to work on things like requiring employers to give more predictability about hours, or requiring employers to give somebody who's part-time but wants more hours before hiring more part-time employees. Those kinds of worker protections are really needed today because so many people have variable schedules, even if they have full-time work. That's one really important area to think about.
What about the job volatility? I mean, there were some careers that you knew, whether it was with the utility company or let's just say here in St. Louis, Anheuser-Busch. If you had the job there, it was like being a civil servant. You had it for life. Some of those jobs, and in some cases, a lot of those jobs went away. And people were so stuck and committed to that particular industry, they lacked training to be able to move on. And then they found themselves taking a job for a whole lot less money. And that's when the hole really starts to get deeper.
It's really true. And when sometimes when I'm talking to people about that, their first instinct is, well, how do we get those manufacturing jobs back? And I think that's the wrong way to think about it, frankly. Yeah. I think the question is, how do you make that new job that the person has taken, right? So this new job is now a lower wage, more insecure job. The question to me is, why? Why can't we make that job a higher wage, more secure job? You know, manufacturing jobs didn't start out as great jobs. They became great jobs, right? They started out at the dawn of the Industrial Revolution as really terrible jobs, dangerous jobs, low-paying jobs, jobs where child labor was common. They became 40-hour-a-week, steady, secure jobs because of unions and activism and companies deciding that they would be more productive if they had a well-rested, safe workforce and seeing that that was a profitable strategy, and ultimately by government regulation. So it's not set in stone that manufacturing jobs are good jobs, but home health care is a bad job. There's no reason why we have to take that as a given. What we have to do is figure out how to make the service jobs that our economy is now delivering into family-supporting jobs, which there's really no reason why they can't be.
And I would assume training is got to be more efficient, where that person who's been used to doing the same thing has to be versatile enough to be able to learn other elements that gives them an opportunity to compete for other jobs as well. You know, you've been used to the factory job or the manufacturing job, and all of a sudden here comes a computer into play or something else that technology has really overtaken that particular field. If you can't keep up, it's pretty hard. So don't jobs and doesn't industry have to be able to do a better job at training?
I think so. And part of that is committing to your employees long-term, your workforce long-term, right? You don't have any incentive to train if you think of your employees as just an hourly cost. You have an incentive to train when you view your workforce as part of your long-term success as a business. Because then, of course, you're going to train them to do their job well. But, you know, we have a lot of companies who aren't really viewing their workforce that way these days. And I think that's a core sort of foundational problem we have to fix.
The name of the book is The Financial Diaries, How an American Family Copes in the World of Uncertainty. The authors, Jonathan Murdoch and Rachel Schneider. They're the authors. Rachel, again, thank you for the time. A very good read as the holiday season comes upon us. And maybe this is something everybody might want to take a look at as they go into the holidays and prepare for 2018. That is Jonathan Murdoch and Rachel Schneider. The name of the book, once again, Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in the World of Uncertainty. Interesting stuff. You might want to pick it up and maybe have something to talk about over the dinner table during the holidays. All right, when we come back, we're going to have a little fun. Quackery. That's right. We're going to talk about these remedies that we've heard so much about. Wives' tales, fool's gold, you name it. We're going to talk about somebody who actually researched this stuff. Stick around. You want to hear about this. It's coming up next here on KMOX. We continue with At Your Service here on KMOX. I'm Mike Claiborne. And, you know, we got an interesting item here we're going to get into today. You've heard about things like curses and mojos and things of that nature. What could go wrong will go wrong. Well, believe it or not, folks, there's a book out. It's called Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything. And we're going to visit with Dr. Linda Kang. She and Nate Peterson wrote the book, and we're going to have a chance to visit with Dr. Kang. So, Dr. Kang, first of all, thank you for joining us. I mentioned at the outset curing things, and I also mentioned mojo and voodoo and things of that nature. Let's talk a little bit about how we arrived at this book, because it is quite interesting, some of the wives' tales and things that people have passed on over the course of time to cure things. It's been always an amusing approach that people have had. So tell me, how did we arrive at this?
Well, so, you know, my co-author, Nate Peterson, and I were thinking of writing a book together, and we thought a little bit about quackery, but, you know, all we really knew about were things like we'd heard about leeches and bloodletting and lobotomies, but not a whole lot more. And the more we started to delve into it, the more we realized, oh my gosh, this stuff is unbelievable. The mercury, the arsenic, the strychnine, these terrible things that you would never think that people would use were being used all the time. And so we kind of knew we had to write a book about it. So that's sort of how it happened.
All right. As you go through the research and you hear about things along the course of the way, what is the most common one you've heard of as far as a cure? And what's the one that has the best success rate?
Well, you know, some of the things that we came about that were really, really common, bloodletting is a huge one. I mean, they used to just open up a vein in your arm, take out like half a pint or even more for everything. I mean, if you had a fever, they would bleed you. If you had a stomach ache, they would bleed you. It's almost like a joke, and there's actually a Saturday Night Live, like, you know, a skit about this. But literally, you have anything that's wrong, and they bleed you. And that was the same case with leeches and so many of these other things. I was pretty horrified to find out, you know, a lot of people are afraid of things like mercury. It's like a heavy metal. It, like, sometimes it's in your fish, so you can't eat too much tuna fish.
Right.
So I'd heard about that. I didn't realize how incredibly common it was for people to take mercury as a treatment for the same reasons, like for anything that was wrong. And it gave you this, I hate to say, horrible diarrhea, but that's how people thought, like, ooh, it's working, it's making me feel better. But people really made themselves do some awful stuff throughout the ages.
It sounds like the placebo in a lot of cases, where if you believe it's going to work, then it will work.
Absolutely. And, you know, the placebo effect is incredibly strong. I love the placebo effect when it works because it means people do get better. But a lot of times it meant people kept using some of these really poisonous things over and over again because they really thought it was going to work. I mean, a classic example is, hey, I have a really bad cold, so I'm going to slap some leeches on my chest. And well, guess what? That cold was going to go away anyway, and so when you're all better, you're like, see, I told you those leeches were going to work. And I think that's how a lot of these things got passed down from generation to generation.
We're visiting with Dr. Lydia Kang. She and Nate Peterson have co-authored a book entitled Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything. So as we look at this, I'm sure they're in different parts of the world, different cultures have their own methods of curing illnesses as well.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, we touch a little bit on that. We kind of stuck mostly to, like, Western medicine, stuff that was happening in Europe and America. But, you know, every once in a while you come across one of these things. Like, there was this emperor in China who was really, really famous, who wanted very much to be immortal. Like, he wanted to live forever. And so his apothecaries kept giving him mercury pills, saying, hey, mercury is a silvery, beautiful metal. You keep eating it, you'll live forever. Well, guess what? He died from the mercury poisoning. So, you know, it's not just, you know, us Americans that are, you know, obsessed with our health. It's all over the world. There's stories from ancient Egypt where people, you know, were doing all these different, like, tons and tons of enemas for health and other things. And, you know, we are not, it is a universal human thing that people want to stay healthy and they want to live as long as they can.
Well, that's apparent. So what is the one that I guess that you had a chance to look at that probably garnered the most attention with the most minimal result?
Oh, my gosh. Well, here's one that I think is particularly gruesome and kind of gross and probably didn't do anything. And that was cannibalism and corpse medicine. We're going into Halloween, so hopefully people actually find this kind of entertaining. But, yeah, some people used to think that, like, a dead body could help heal them. Like, they would swing by the gallows, you know, after somebody, like a criminal had been hung in England, and they would come by if they had, like a boil on their hand or something, and they would rub the boil on the hanging dead body because they thought it would heal it. And obviously it didn't, but people thought, like, there was a magical substance in a recently dead body that could do these things. And I was reading this thing going, like, you must be kidding me. This is, like, out of a fairy tale, but it's really actually happened.
This is kind of getting off the track here. It's quite interesting. So with all the items that you researched and all the cures that you read about and had to learn about firsthand, which one have you applied to yourself, friends, and or family?
Oh, gosh. Okay. Let's see. I got to look through this real quick. I would say, I know of somebody in the dieting chapter. I know of somebody who, like, kind of tried to wear, like, a rubber, like, girdle to
right.
try to help them lose weight. So I've heard about that one amongst a friend. And for these other ones, Oh, my gosh. No, I'm really happy to say that no one's done tobacco smoke enema or fed their children cocaine when they're teething. Thank goodness. I'm like flipping through this going, please tell me that we haven't done any of these things. And I don't think we actually have. So, yeah, we're good here.
That's good to hear. All right, so you should live at least a healthy life and probably normal compared to some of the cures that you've been able to read about. Well, doctor, it's fascinating. It's amusing for sure that people will go to any extreme to give themselves greater health and certainly longevity with life. What did you come away with? Is this your first writing? Is this your first book?
This is my first nonfiction book.
Okay.
So I usually write fiction. I've written like historical mysteries called A Beautiful Poison, and I write young adult science fiction, and I have a book called The November Girl coming out in November that's young adult. So this is my first nonfiction book, and it was an absolute blast to write.
Well, it sounds like this won't be your last.
No, I don't think so. I think we're going to keep going. We just got to find something that's going to be just as fun to write about.
Well, quackery is certainly at the top of the list, and you did a great job, you and your co-partner, Nate Peterson. Dr. Kang, thank you for your time. It is an amusing book, to say the least. Certainly something to have around the table during the holidays. And I'm sure if somebody reads this and they bring it up at Thanksgiving dinner, you may see some people leave the table.
Oh, I believe so.
Thank you again for your time. Best of luck with the book. She is Dr. Linda Kang, Lydia Kang. The name of the book is entitled Quackery, A Brief History of the World's Worst Ways to Cure Everything. Thank you again.
Thanks for having me.
All right. That's Dr. Lydia Kang. And okay, some of that stuff we know is goofy, but, you know, some of that stuff obviously works. I'm just going to go with the things that I know have worked for me. How about that? It's At Your Service. It's Sunday afternoon. I'm Mike Claiborne. We welcome you being part of the show today. Well, there are a lot of things that we talk about on this show, and a lot of times we get into the world of cybersecurity and the fact that privacy as we know it has become limited these days, and your identity is shared by more people than you can ever imagine. Now, there are methods to take order in order to take yourself in a position to be better protected. There's a lot of ways to do it. We're going to talk with one person today. He is Dr. Eric Cole. He holds a PhD, and he's also the CEO of Securing Anchoring Consulting. He has a book that's called How to Protect Yourself and Your Loved Ones from the Evil Side of the Internet, and the book is scheduled to come out in January of 2018. Eric, thank you so much for joining us. Quite an impressive resume. I just touched the surface that you had a PhD. Give our listeners an idea of how much ring experience you actually have at this issue.
I love this topic. I've worked in it for 30 years. I was a commissioner for President Obama. I do a lot of work with high-profile folks, chief scientists of Lockheed Martin. And my mission is really to help people be safe online.
Well, you know, when you talk about being safe online, when did Big Brother, as we know him, along with the now new in-laws, when did they join in and have so much of an impact on keeping tabs on us?
It's since we've sort of gone to a digital age, everybody loves the technology. We love the fact that we have cell phones. But what we don't realize is anything that can be used for good can be used for evil. So a cell phone becomes a tracking device. All of our information on social media now becomes a way that people can verify and validate us. And what people don't realize in electronic world on the internet, there is no delete button. Once you create something, it will exist forever, and anybody, including Big Brother, can track you.
Well, let's talk about two things here. First of all, you talk about the cell phone, the camera phone, great item. But what are we doing when we allow this item to have access to us? And also to follow up on your recent statement with regard to deleting items, is it that easy to retrieve it? Because most of us think when we hit delete, it's gone forever. And you obviously say that that's not necessarily true. So how easy is it to retrieve?
The short answer is easy. And let me explain why. When you go in and you delete something, whether it's on your phone or with your computer, all you're doing is removing a link to that item in the application. The data is still on your hard drive. So anybody that can get access can access the information. And here's the scary part. You do a cloud backup, and that information, people think this cloud is sort of this magical thing. All it is servers around the world And the scariest part is most of those servers are replicated in the Philippines. And the reason that's scary is the Philippines has no privacy laws, which means if anybody gets access to the server in the Philippines, your data is open and available and can be used for anything.
So the Philippines is now the new hotbed for cyber terror or cybersecurity issues?
Well, the Philippines is the hotbed for data centers because it's so cheap and easy and it's away from the mainland, but they don't have any laws there, so the data is accessible. The real hot area, which shouldn't surprise you, is Russia. That's where a ton of this organized crime is coming from, because a lot of these brilliant scientists in the former Soviet Union can't get jobs. But you go to cybercrime and you can make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year right from your own apartment.
Dr. Eric Cole is with us. He's the CEO of his company, Secure Anchor Consulting, but he also has a book coming out in January, and that is entitled How to Protect Yourself and Your Loved Ones from the Evil Side of the Internet. Now, going back to the other issue with regard, you talk about deletion and how that doesn't necessarily exist, but the camera phone itself, what are we doing when we turn that thing on? What are we allowing to happen unbeknownst to us?
When you go in and turn that on, essentially, any application that you gave access to can access that camera or that microphone whenever it wants. And that's the thing you want to be so careful of. Most of us love our apps. I don't know about you, but a lot of people have five or six screens of apps and all this extra stuff. Every one of those apps could spy on us, because when we install the app, we're so tempted to say allow, 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 and we don't realize when we're allowing that camera, that's saying for indefinitely, we're allowing that app whenever it wants without telling us to turn that on. So basically our cell phones can spy on us. So the trick is remove and turn off apps that you're not using.
Now, the other issue that comes into play here, reading the fine print is something few of us actually do, because we just want the app. And in all honesty, are we just signing our rights away as well?
Yes, what people don't realize is there is no such thing as free. Everyone's like, oh, it's a free app. No, it's not. What you're agreeing to is an exchange. They're giving you the app, and in return, you're allowing them to use your data and information, and most people don't realize that. If I went in and said, okay, this app, you're agreeing to access your personal data, they want to download it, but they hear the word free, and they go, oh, let me put it on my phone.
So if that's the case, other than not agreeing to the fine print, what can the consumer do to protect themselves from cyber crimes?
The biggest thing is to reduce your exposure. So most of the apps that you have on your phone you're not using, get rid of those. Also, a lot of the non-critical, like games and others, those are the ones that are developed in Russia and tend to have the biggest exposure. Also, go in under your privacy and look at all the apps that have access to your location, to your phone, to your camera, and go in and turn off all of those. Minimize your exposure. I'm not saying don't use an app, but recognize the vulnerability and minimize what an adversary can do.
Very interesting. Very simple, but yet certainly effective. Now, are the bad guys really ahead of the posse that much? And how dangerous is the international threat that we hear so much about?
So, the adversary is ahead of us, but the reason is because most people are not cyber aware. Most of us, when we grew up, our parents sat down with us and told us, don't talk to strangers, look both ways before crossing a street. So we have good awareness in the real world. Nobody ever talked to us about cybersecurity. So many people think it's secure, and they just do really silly things like post information to Facebook and others that put themselves at risk. And the other problem is a lot of these adversaries are coming from countries in which it's not necessarily illegal, so it makes it very, very hard to prosecute or take action.
Yeah, and I would assume that they understand that, and they know all the anguish that you would go through if you're able to even catch anyone. It really isn't worth it at the end of the day with the time, money, and effort that you would put into it.
Exactly.
So your book is coming out in January. Give us just a couple of hints on what we can look for that's going to make us a more effective person when it comes to having this cell phone in my hand and making sure that what information I still would like to hold on to, I can still maintain.
So a couple things. First is, with your cell phone, minimize the apps, turn off location services. And I know it sounds obvious, but don't take naked pictures of yourself, right? Don't put anything on that phone that could be used to hurt you. I mean, I sometimes joke with people when they get into this trouble. I'm like, come on, isn't that common sense not to do this? So like you said, cybersecurity is really just about doing common sense things like you would in the real world, but recognize that in cyber, you're just at risk, and you need to go in and just be smart about what you do and what information you give out.
All right. Dr. Eric Cole, we thank you for your time today. Once again, the book comes out in January. The name of the book is How to Protect Yourself and Your Loved Ones from the Evil Side of the Internet. Eric, thank you so much for your time. Best of luck with the book. And I'm looking forward to talking to you to make sure I'm on track and making sure the big brother and the in-laws that have come with him don't invade the rest of my privacy.
Yep, I'll keep you safe. I'll be there for you.
Well, there you have it. We thank Dr. Eric Cole for that bit of advice, not to mention Lydia Kang on quackery and Rachel Schneider talking a little bit about financial diaries in American families and how they cope in the world of uncertainty. We're out of time for today, folks. We've had a blast putting this on for you. Hopefully you enjoyed it. Maybe you're a little smarter today. At least you have something to talk about tomorrow. We invite you to join us the next time. We're going to be off for a couple of weeks due to Chiefs football, but when we come back, we're going to have some fun like we always do. We've got some great guests lined up, and hopefully you'll be part of what we do. So for Chris Myhill, who helps us out immensely on this show, I'm Mike Claiborne. We thank you once again for listening to another installment of At Your Service on your Voice for St. Louis, KMOX.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I know, right? I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
Oh, no, I meant those blackout motorized shades. MVP of the room.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. Even you could do it.
Nice.
I installed these and then got some for my mom, too.
What, you fly across the country to do the install?
Nope. Blinds.com can do it all. All she had to do was pick what she wanted. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Look at you, a Hall of Fame son.
Oh, I just picked the winning team. They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Oh, Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
He shoots. He scores.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 45% off and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Go right now for up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.